Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, December 17th. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network. Every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
Today you'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we got another great show for you today that's going to include, do physically fit students perform better academically?
And can you prevent fractures with leafy greens?
And can gut bacteria protect against a stroke? Well, that's getting far out there.
And can we create wellness through national prevention policies?
And can dogs sniff out superbug infections? This is going to be a great show.
You know, exercise isn't just good for our bodies, but a new study shows that physical fitness, including endurance, muscular strength, and flexibility, all add up to better grades and performance on tests for students. And exercising in nature, away from electronics, fosters creativity.
So we really got something here to look at. And this was published in the Journal of Sports Medicine and Physical Fitness. And we know that physical education is being cut out of schools now and that physical activity throughout the day is really slipping away. If kids have 1 hour of physical education during the day instead of one academic class, they didn't show a decrease in academic improvement. They actually showed an increase. So it's what we do in terms of staying fit physically that we're talking about here.
And what about adding, like, wilderness trips?
Another thing, that improves our creativity. I think that's a great one. That was,
you know, some of the schools do have camps, but that's not during normal school time. I think that's, like, during vacation times and so forth. But, you know, they call them camps.
What we're looking at here is different ways to make people work better. And I don't mean work just because it's something that we do that we don't like. I mean how we function better, how we function optimally at every level. We're talking about body, mind, emotion, and spirit. We're looking at science and the arts and physical and biochemical aspects of who we are, and certainly spiritual aspects as well.
Well, most of the schools just emphasize the academic part of it, you know. But we're, like you said, we're a whole person, body, mind, emotion, spirit. All those things need to be taken, tended to.
You know, it's interesting, Vicki. Last week, a counselor from school called me and said that he'd like to get together and talk.
What do you mean, a counselor from school?
A counselor from my daughter's school when she was in high school.
Oh.
He called and he said, "I'd like to talk to you." And I said, "Well, what about?" And he says, "Well, I was your daughter's counselor and I always really liked her. And what I was doing was working outside of the academics of school. There was a class that he gave that had to do with how kids deal with life. So I talked to my daughter Julie about it, and she says, "Oh, yeah, I remember Jeff. He was great. One of the highlights of her academic experience at her high school." And what he does is he looks at academics as one thing. I mean, sure, we need more nuclear physicists, but we also need people who can do things in life that are constructive, that make them happy, that build community, that are about giving and sharing and loving. And that's what this class was about. And we had a blast talking about that and how my medical practice really integrates in the field of medicine like his practice in psychology does with kids in school. And now he's teaching this at a junior college in our area. And it's wonderful to see people like this that get it, that they know it's not just about making astrophysics a subject that everybody masters, but life is what we master.
Our granddaughter takes a class, and right at the moment, I can't remember what it's called, but she has it first period. And it's the same teacher that she's had for the last 3 years, and this is her senior year in high school.
Yeah, they're teaching life skills.
But the kids in the class all know each other, and the teacher checks in with each of them and how they're doing. And, I mean, it's really, she's just wonderful.
Well, the whole thing about our educational system needs work. I mean, we're turning out people that are doing good on star testing, but how good are they doing at being citizens? Do we live by the golden rule? Are we getting out of life that that kick that we want.
Well, we used to think of classes like music and art as Mickey Mouse classes, you know, and PE didn't count.
That's because it didn't make astrophysicists out of people. And science and math seem to be the things that everybody's leaning as the most important.
But the thing is that if they cut out PE,
right,
the students aren't going to be doing as well. If they put PE back in, their grades might be better.
They might feel better, too, and be more alert mentally. I mean, look what happens to older people who do exercise, particularly the ones that are at risk for Alzheimer's disease. Great evidence across the board that if you do physical exercise and you improve your social skills, you're going to and you work on doing things like crossword puzzles or stay active in some kind of endeavor that you like. I mean, this business of retiring at age 65 is the dumbest thing I ever saw for people who are really engaged in what they do because they think they're making a contribution. All these aspects of who we are absolutely vital at making a rounded out person and a brain that's strong in all the domains of what we're talking about here.
I remember when I went to college, that was when I quit PE because when I was in high school, we had to take PE.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
me too.
And
I thought, well, I don't have time for that because I need to be putting all right. my time into studying.
Look what that did
and
for
I
you.
And I would push myself so much to put the time into studying that I wasn't really absorbing that much because I was so darn tired.
Right.
And I would get about 3 hours sleep a night, and I've told you this story before, but sometimes I'd fall asleep even taking notes in the class. The
yeah.
teacher would be lecturing, and I could see from my notes that they would just, like, go off the page in a straight line, you know?
Well, that's what happens.
But anyway, I want to finish the story because
okay.
my mother suggested to me to go to bed at a certain time every night, even if I wasn't finished with my homework. And I started doing that, and
good
all
advice.
My grades went up.
Yeah, sure. See, it's not just about grades. That's the problem. It's not about star tests. It's not about making people bright in just one area. It's about making people well-rounded so that what they are is complete human beings and that they're getting the most out of life in a way that's organized. I mean, look what's happened to this country. We're so over-focused on academics, you know, that have to do with the logical side of our lives, that we forget about the emotional side and, most importantly, the spiritual side. We don't have a road map when we're born that tells us what to do with our life. And what happens is that there are a lot of outside sources that are telling us what to do in terms of being what they call successful, but not what I would call successful in life.
Well, one of the things that would be good for people to be taught while they're in school is about what a life's purpose is.
Exactly. That's the roadmap I'm talking
about. A lot of people
about.
Get that in church.
That's right. And you can get it in any church or you can get it in any spiritual domain. For me personally, I'm not particularly religious. For you, you are religious. But how you get the spiritual education is what matters here.
Well, the other thing is, too, is that people are just married to their cell phones now and computers and their, you know, all the technology. And there are a lot of distractions in life. And if you live in the city, there's like the noises that you hear in the city. So, and breaks from TV. And, you know, people many times just have the TV on for company or for noise
right.
in the background.
Right.
But it's good to just take a break from all that. And that's why I think probably this article about being in nature is so helpful. Could get away from a lot of those distractions. And maybe for the first time, notice that maybe you can hear birds singing.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Or look at that butterfly or yeah. just to notice things. Because many times we're so busy, we don't. I watch people now walking across the street. Nobody's even paying attention. They're just talking on the phone. They look like they're all talking to themselves.
That or they're absorbed in something.
Or they're listening to their music.
Right. I think all these distractions we have take away from our being present.
Not to say anything about the electromagnetic field.
Oh, there's so much that we don't really know about that we do anyway because we aren't smart enough to have figured out what they do to the way our bodies, our whole self operates. And the electromagnetics are a huge part of that.
What was interesting, that study they did on being in nature, because it showed that the people that were in nature had 50% more creativity.
They asked them a bunch of questions before they went on the nature hike and then a bunch of questions after 4 days. And what they found is they did a lot better, as you said, at being focused on being present. And that's what a lot of this is about. We have distractions from life. It gets us out of what I call the zone of life. And to me, that means being in the moment as deeply as you can. It's being that little four-year-old kid that sees a flower and it's got a bee on it. And they're just looking at that thing like, isn't that amazing? And they're looking at every aspect of what's happening in the moment. And you go deeper and deeper into what's happening there. And mom calls, hey, Johnny, it's time for lunch. Johnny doesn't even hear it. He's absorbed in what's happening right now. That's the kind of intensity.
Of focus and concentration. Yes. Wouldn't that be good if we could do that in school?
Well, it would be good that if we could be that way in life without separating school from life, because we tend to separate that. And when we do, we get out of that zone of life, and then we start influencing kids to be present in a way that's not deep, that's not authentic, meaning not really where they want to be. That's why I like the Waldorf schools. They give the kid the flexibility of being able to study what they want at the time that they want.
Well, maybe that's one of the reasons that homeschooling is so popular, too.
Well, it can be. I think a lot of that is a reaction against what happens in school. You're so right. And as I look back at my education, I think it was better then than it is today in a lot of ways, because we did have a lot of physical activity. You know, we had PE, you know, after every class we got for 15 minutes and we kick the ball around or throw it through hoops or do something physical.
Well, see, that would be great if people did that in school instead of just, well, they counted exercise, I guess, walking from one class to the next.
Well, it's some, but it's not what we got.
Maybe they could skip.
Yeah. And as my education got deeper and I went on to the University of California in Berkeley and then off to Duke Medical School and then did internship and residency, I think it got worse and worse and worse because it got more and more narrow and more focused on academic achievement.
You were playing tennis, though, weren't you?
Yeah, I was different than most of my peers. I played tennis my whole life. You know, I started out when I was a kid with athletics because I thought it was so important. And I still, at my ripe old age, am playing tennis now. And that physical activity does a lot to keep me sharp. And I think it balances things. What I missed to some extent were some of the arts. You know, I do play the piano, and I enjoy that. It's a kind of rhythm that keeps your mind attuned, I think, in another dimension that is interesting. It's hard to describe what exactly it does.
Yeah, I'd love to know how you do it. He plays by ear.
Well, I can't read notes anymore, but I learned piano from the time I was 6 till when I was 12.
And I did, too, and I can't do that.
No, well, I didn't like it at the time. It was forced down my throat, so I learned classical music. And then when I didn't have to do it anymore, it was such a relief. And then I didn't play for about 10 years. And after I got back, forgot how to read the notes and could play by ear, I find it very relaxing. And it, too, adds another domain. And the arts, you know, acting and sculpturing and painting all develop different parts of the brain. And what we want is to be as whole and as complete a person as we can. So while we don't see practical things for everybody, I mean, not everybody's going to be an artist or a piano player or a doctor or whatever it is that's their goal. All these things help develop our brain in a way that it works synchronistically and deeper and more efficiently, and it's richer if we have the broader education.
I think it would also be good in schools to teach the students about giving. You know, how to help other people.
Absolutely. How,
maybe to take them in groups to go to convalescent hospitals and maybe visit the people or the patients there or sing to them or read to them or, you know, just something to interact with them.
Well, it's why this class.
Play games with them, maybe.
It's why this class that Jeff, okay, Julie's teacher, was giving to the kids. It was a class on life skills and how to get along and what their purpose was. And I think he probably saved a lot of kids being so frustrated that they gave up academically or they checked out of school or they didn't finish or whatever it was, because he was looking at the whole person. He made it fun. He made it fair. He practiced the golden rule. They build community. When somebody did something to somebody else, they talked about it. Why did you do that? What happened? What were you thinking at the time? Would you do that again? Do you think that was a smart thing to do? And all these things are what make a teacher special. So Jeff was special. He really got to the core of what's going on. And by the way, his school wasn't so fond of him. They at one point tried to get rid of him.
Why?
Because they thought that he was getting too much off the track of academics. And of course, this is the silliest thing of all time. And today, he's a huge success because all the students want to take his classes. Because they're getting something out of it where they're really present. learning where that zone of life is, the learning how to get into things in a deep sort of way and look at what am I doing with my life at this time? Is this where I want to be? Do I want to be focused on this kind of stuff, or do I want to be a bookworm? Do I want to be somebody who is being encouraged to be a mathematician or a scientist or a doctor or whatever it is that you're being encouraged to do? Kids need to find out who they are and what matters to them.
Well, everybody admits that there's a lot of dysfunction that goes on because everybody always jokes that, you know, the dysfunction would be if you came from a family that wasn't dysfunctional. Oh,
well, that's true. What family's not dysfunctional some way?
And nowadays we hear about so many dysfunctions, you know, with all the high divorce rate and many times people live together
the
and
suicide
not married
rates and the drug usage and, you know, what gets people out of the situations they're in. When I see somebody who has a challenge in life, whether it be alcohol or a drug or if it's they're depressed, I'm always looking, what's going on here? What's the deeper reason?
Maybe in their families. Maybe their parents are abusing them. You don't know.
Most people are abused in some way, physically, emotionally, spiritually, sexually. I don't know anybody who wasn't to some extent abused. And maybe sometimes it was just because they had the parents put expectations on them. And if they did good or they were number one or they succeeded in some way, then they were really rewarded. But they were rewarded for what they did. They weren't being rewarded for
who they were.
That's exactly the point. And that's what we need to bring back into America. That's why America, in a lot of ways, is failing. It's become a competitive, adversarial place to live. It's about accumulating wealth and things. It's not so much about what you can give or share or do or to help somebody along. I love being a doctor because I know that I'm helping people and I'm not just there trying to treat their symptoms. It's not like putting a Band-Aid over the brake light. If somebody's blood pressure is high, for example, I don't just give them a drug and say, here, take this drug or that drug, and you'll do better. It's like,
that'd be a good person to exercise.
Well, it sure would. It sure would. And there are a lot of things that they can do to find out, why is my blood pressure going up? And most of the time, there's a darn good reason for it. It's because they're tight about something. They're super tense about some aspect of life they can't resolve. And that causes a cortisol release and an adrenaline, a noradrenaline release, and probably 1,000 other hormones that are in our body adapting to that. And what do you expect? Yeah, your blood pressure goes up because you're in a fight or flight response to some extent. That's normal. I would worry about that person if their blood pressure didn't go up. There'd be something wrong with their adrenals or something wrong with their brain or their neurotransmitters. So being somebody who listens and cares about people, the goal then is to find ways to stretch people to find out what went wrong. It's even, why do you have lupus or why do you have cancer or why do you have anything? There are always reasons in my belief system, and not in everybody's belief system, that the universe is perfect and it's teaching us lessons through the body. So the body becomes a reflector of our psycho-spiritual dis-ease. That's a powerful statement. And it's not easy to practice that. And we aren't taught that as doctors or as psychologists. We're looking at the biochemistry and physiology and now a little bit about the biophysics, thinking we're solving all this stuff. But that's not solving all this stuff. That's good for Big Pharma because they're selling lots of drugs. When you've got the average 65-year-old or older taking 4 or 5, 6 or 8 or 10 or 15 drugs, I have some people coming in with 20 drugs. They've got Band-Aids over brake lights and everything that's in their body. And they're not addressing the real issue that's there because nobody's paying attention to it. We're looking at the superficial nature of what's happening. And that's why our education at home, when we're, you know, in the first 4 or 5 years of our life, and thereafter when we're in school, we need an educational system that looks at how do we get people to flourish? How do we get them in the moment? How do we get them fully to express themselves for who they are? How do they contribute to what's happening in life?
Well, and one way is to exercise and get out in nature and disconnect from technology because it affects our whole body and creativity and our well-being and our quality of life.
You're right. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on As Julie Andrews Turns 79. And when we come back, we'll be talking about Can You Prevent Fractures with Leafy Greens? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
is kind of an oldie, but I just wanted to share it because I think it's kind of fun. And it was done a few years ago to commemorate her birthday, Julie Andrews. She made this special appearance at Manhattan's Radio City Music Hall. And one of the musical numbers that she performed was My Favorite Things from the movie Sound of Music.
Mm.
So what I want you to do is to hum along with me as I read the lyrics. And I might slip and I might sing a little bit of it, but I'm off key. I can't carry a tune. So anyway, let's just have some fun. Botox and nose drops and needles for knitting, walkers and handrails and new dental fittings, bundles of magazines tied up in strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Cadillacs and cataracts, hearing aids and glasses, Polident and Fixident and false teeth and glasses, pacemakers, golf carts, and porches with swings. These are a few of my favorite things. When the pipes leak, when the bones creak, when the knees go bad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. Hot tea and crumpets and corn pads for bunions. No spicy hot food or food cooked with onions. Bathrobes and heating pads and hot meals they bring. These are a few of my favorite things. Back pain, confused brains, and no need for sinning. Thin bones and fractures and hair that's a thinning. And we won't mention our short shrunken frames when we remember our favorite things. When the joints ache, when the hips break, when the eyes grow dim. Then I remember the life I've had, and then I don't feel so bad.
Oh, that's fantastic, Vicki. Yay, I love it.
Well, I wish I could sing.
But... You can. See, it's the spirit you come across. What wonderful. That's a great story.
Yeah, I
of course, it,
was...
describes what happens, and we might as well go with it, because otherwise it's going to go at us.
Yeah, we might as well laugh at ourselves, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Vicki, as I've aged, I wouldn't give back a single day to gain more physical skills. As I've gotten older and my body doesn't do the things that I like what it does or what it used to do, I remember how dumb I was and how hard I worked to learn the things I know today.
Well, today,
and I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Well, today, too, you were telling Julie how her hair was getting gray.
I know, my daughter.
How it made you feel old. And then you said, but at least you have hair.
Yeah, that's right. I'll take a few of those strands if you got some glue. No, that's great. I mean, if we go through life, a lot of the time we get angry about the things that we lose. And by the time we get into our 80s and 90s, you don't see too many people playing quarterback in pro football, do you?
No, I don't think so.
No, you'd be in there for one play. But think of how wise you get and what you learn in life and all the good things like teachers like Jeff taught, okay, that we talked about in the last segment here, are so important for getting the value of being in the zone of life and gaining a little bit of wisdom so we know what to do as we move on through the stages of our life.
Well, and speaking of the joints and the hips and the and all that business, you know, and the bones creaking and everything, there's more to strong bones than exercise and calcium. So mm-hmm. Did you know that when you fall or you experience trauma, even if you don't break a bone, that you're weakening your bone structure and causing small little holes in your bones?
Right.
That's really scary. How does this happen?
Well, it's just the way two proteins in bone work. One's called osteocalcin. And the other is called osteopontin. And when they become deformed, and they again are like the steel structure in a concrete building, when that becomes deformed in some way, then the bones weaken and they form these little holes. And of course, that moves you towards being susceptible to more fractures.
So when you fall down and you think, oh, phew, I didn't break my whatever it was,
and
my
that's
hip.
Good news. You didn't want to break it. But you've
weakened
it.
But maybe you're setting yourself up to break it the next time.
I think so. And maybe it puts you at a slightly higher risk for bone, even osteoporosis. It would be a very interesting thing to study. So that's what these people who published in this medical journal were talking about.
So there are bone cells, different ones.
Right.
There's the osteoblasts. And right. They're the osteoclasts.
Right.
So the osteoblasts, those lay down new bone.
Yep.
And the osteocalcin is secreted by those osteoblasts
yes.
and build healthy bone, preventing the osteoporosis.
Exactly.
So why is vitamin K important in this process?
Well, you can't, osteocalcin doesn't do its work until it has a chemical reaction that's called carboxylation.
Well,
it's not. It's just making a reaction occur to change it in some small way that makes it work.
So it makes the vitamin K get inside the bone.
It makes your bones stronger because it enables osteocalcin to lay down new bone. That's what it does. So the problem we have in treating people with anticoagulants such as heparin or Coumadin is that they block that reaction, and we wind up with bones that aren't strong anymore.
So many people that are on Coumadin have what you call a side effect, but it's an effect of it, of osteoporosis.
It's a to-be-expected effect from people who are on Coumadin that they will develop thinning bones and osteoporosis.
And it's interesting because many times their doctors, I've talked to people that have told me that they can't even eat
the green leafy
vegetables because they're afraid of the vitamin K, because vitamin K is supposed to help your blood to clot, and they're trying to not have their blood clot. So that's why they're on the Coumadin.
Okay, so let's get specific about that. What happens with Coumadin is that it will keep your blood thin, but in the process, it's not able to function if there's too much vitamin K around, because vitamin K works to reverse the anticoagulant effect of Coumadin. And that's why we have relatively a vitamin K deficiency when our doctors tell us don't eat the sources for vitamin K, which are the green leafy vegetables. My patients, I tell them, eat all the green leafies you can get in you. I want you to have vitamin K so it can do all the good things that it does to have our bones and the rest of our tissues heal. You can't heal without vitamin K. And so what you do then to take that into account is give a little tiny bit more Coumadin if that's what you want to give for anticoagulation. And most of the time, I don't use Coumadin in my
practice.
Probably
use fish oil.
I use a lot of other things that can accomplish the same thing.
Nattokinase.
Yes, sometimes lumbrokinase and ginkgo biloba, and as you mentioned, fish oil. Those are all things that will help to keep blood from clotting. Now, I agree that it's a risk if you have atrial fibrillation or if you have recurring episodes of thrombophlebitis or if you have cancer, that your blood is going to be thicker and put you more at a risk for developing these things. But what we can do in this setting is look at the live blood and see what it's like as it's living in a dark field microscope and see if the red cells and platelets are clumping together because of too much coagulation. So I think we have a major problem in anticoagulation in hematology, okay, as doctors are treating people who tend to have blood that's too thick with drugs rather than with approaches that are natural that don't have all these side effects.
Well, you know from firsthand experience that how well it works to do fish oil or nattokinase because you did that on yourself with a live blood cell analysis.
That's right.
When you had the metallosis from your hip.
When I had cobalt poisoning. That's poisoning. One of the things is hypercoagulation, and that can lead to heart attacks and strokes.
I remember
which
you
we
went
avoided.
To go have the live blood cell analysis before you had taken anything, mm-hmm. and your blood was all full of fibrin and clumpy and clot and everything.
Exactly.
And then you took the fish oil and waited an hour, and then it was all cleared up. And you did the same thing the next time with the nattokinase, and it all cleared up, and it looked fine and normal.
That's right. So
now, many people that are on that have osteoporosis. Osteoporosis are prescribed bisphosphonates like the Boniva and Actonel and so forth.
Actonel and Zomida and Fosamax, that's right.
So how do those work versus nutrition and eating healthy with the vitamin K and the calcium?
Well, I think it's insane to be using bisphosphonates. That's my opinion. Look at the side effects they have. They can cause stomach ulcers. They can cause necrosis of your jaw. And let me tell you, that's a big deal. They cause atrial fibrillation in a certain percentage of people. Some of the long bones of the femur actually fracture after you've been on it for a few years.
Because those are the ones that kill the osteoclasts.
That's right.
Which eat old bones. So the old bone stays and it fills up the osteoporosis holes with old bone.
That's right. Not a good idea.
So this is why nutrition is better, I guess.
Well, it also causes esophageal cancer. After you've been on it for about 5 years, that risk goes up, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association. And a lot of people get muscle pain that can be excruciating from it, so that you can't take it. So this is not a great solution to try and solve this problem. So if you want to prevent bone fractures, eat your leafy greens. And remember that if you do have osteoporosis or osteopenia, the best solution is not drugs, it's lifestyle using supplements that include vitamin K. It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about, can gut bacteria protect against a stroke? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
We know that friendly bacteria are good for the gut and for irritable bowel syndrome and colitis. And not long ago, we reported that probiotics can improve diabetes and asthma and autoimmune diseases. But who would think probiotics could prevent arteriosclerotic heart disease, heart attacks, and strokes? Well, the Swedes did a study, and what did they find?
It's an interesting study. What they did is they took a group of people who were stroke patients and compared them with a group of healthy subjects, and they found that there were big differences in the gut, what they call microbiota. And what that means is all the genes that are associated with the human body that we have in combination with all the genes that bacteria have that are in the gut. So the pool of genes and DNA in the gut is enormous because there are 10 times as many microbes in the gut as there are cells in the human body. So these bugs that live inside of our intestinal tracts are providing a ton of genetic information that determines how our body functions. And in this particular study, what they did is they looked to see in those stroke patients if there was a difference in the genetic makeup in the ability to make what they call carotenoids, things like beta carotene. And interestingly enough, the people who were at risk for stroke didn't have this ability near to the extent as normal people do. The real go ahead.
I was just thinking, in light of these types of studies that mainstream medicine, do you think that they'll start treating illnesses with different combinations of microbes now?
We're already doing that. And I think
but
that
medical doctors, I didn't think, did that too much.
Well, 10 years ago, you talk about probiotics to most doctors, and they're going, what are you talking about? Because they just didn't have any fund of knowledge there. But you can go back 100 years ago to the studies of a Russian named Elie Metchnikoff, who was talking about the composition of the microbes in the gut affecting our health in a major way. And he got a little carried away because what he did for some people was actually take their colons out, because he thought that by getting rid of certain bacteria, people get well. But he was obviously crazy there, because that's not the case. But what we've learned over the last 100 years is that the relationship that we have as human beings with our intestinal microflora is very powerful medicine. And it determines whether or not we're going to be healthy or not. So if the microflora, the 1,000 different species of microbes that are there, are out of balance because we've taken an antibiotic and killed them, or we've taken drugs like steroids and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and birth control pills. We take any of those things and oodles of other things, it changes the relationship that we have with that huge DNA pool that these bacteria have with its human host.
So let's talk some more about these carotenoids. Now, carotenoids are antioxidants.
Mm-hmm. Anti-inflammatory.
Okay, so you said that the bacterial genes for these carotenoids—
to make them in the gut, yes.
Yeah, produce more in healthy people than in people that have had a stroke.
Exactly.
So what about supplements of beta-carotene?
Well, they've been touted to be very valuable. And in some studies, it shows that it protects against arteriosclerosis, which includes strokes and heart attacks. But in many others, it didn't. So the question is what are we looking at here and what really makes the difference? Do we depend on something from those bacteria in the gut that make carotenoids? Do we depend on them to produce something besides the carotenoids that are keeping us from having a stroke? That metabolism, that cellular biochemistry, is extremely complex. And so the answer is it may be. And so if we change the microflora of the gut and we put in bacteria in a probiotic that we take by mouth, can we change the physiology that occurs as it's making more beta-carotene from us?
So like a targeted probiotic.
It'd be a specific one, yes. And we're finding out that different strains of the gut bacteria have different effects on the biochemistry and physiology of our bodies.
You know, it's interesting. When you go to the health food store to buy probiotics, a lot of them have like millions of...
Billions.
Of
some of them have 100 billion...
Of microbes in there, of the friendly bacteria. So you just figure there's so many in there that it's going to hit what you need?
No. Well, people have figured a lot of things, but what, a lot of what they figure isn't right.
I mean, how do you get the
one
right
size
ones?
Fits all doesn't do it, Vicki. That's what you're trying to point out. And that's correct. So what we need are tailor-made prescriptions for probiotics to change around the biochemistry that's occurring in the gut and its effect both genetically and in biochemical terms with the human host.
It seems like lately that we're reporting on probiotics.
All the time.
All the time. They keep coming up with more uses for them.
Well, as we study it more, we find out what's there. I mean, the genetic signature of the DNA and the genes that are in the intestinal tract is enormous. And we're in a very complex symbiotic relationship with these microbes and our cells. And if the balance isn't right, then we have a problem. And when the wrong microbes overgrow, so, for example, a Shigella or a Salmonella or a C. diff or a Campylobacter bacteria overgrows, MRSA too, you wind up making the products that these bacteria make that very often make what's called endotoxin, which is something that's very toxic for us. In small amounts, our bodies can adapt to it and we can handle it, and it's not a big issue. But in larger amounts, it produces so much endotoxin that we wind up with all kinds of signs of gastroenteritis, or if it invades the body, things that happen inside the body as well.
Because, like, if you just have a little of it and you're healthy, then the probiotics can crowd it out.
Exactly.
But if you're sick and you're immune compromised or what have you, then
it becomes much more of a problem. So this whole business of the microflora of the gut playing a role in our health is enormous. And the potential here, according to these people and according to me too, I mean, there are thousands of articles out there now supporting this, show that we need to have the right balance of microbes there. And if we don't, then all kinds of things can happen that can be a challenge for us. So I think that we have to start thinking in terms of what's happening in our bodies, in terms of how we live with our environment.
And the balance.
Well, the balance between the kinds of bugs that are in the intestinal tract have an effect on what's called intestinal permeability, and it can cause the so-called leaky gut syndrome. Now, think about it. We've got a huge metabolic plant going on in the gut where there's more metabolic activity than there is in any organ system in the body. There's huge metabolism going on there.
It's considered its own organ.
I consider it that, and I think a lot of people do. And when we have that kind of metabolic activity, the relationship we have with it is crucial in terms of regulating the size of the pores that are in the intestinal tract. The spaces between the cells determine the pore size, and when the pore size gets big, it gets big enough in some cases where whole bacteria can go from the inside of the intestinal tract to the inside of the body.
So these are the bad bacteria?
Any bacteria, the good ones and the bad ones, but they're supposed to be in the gut. They're not supposed to be inside the body. And when they get there, because two-thirds of the immune system of the entire body is in the intestinal tract, it sets up a relationship that's very complicated and important.
It sounds like it could lead to peritonitis.
Well, it could, and in some cases it does.
Which is one of the things that people fear if they have a ruptured appendix.
Well, or any kind of infection in the gut, from diverticulitis or appendicitis or innumerable other perforated gut. I mean, all kinds of things can do that. So we need to look at this relationship that we have and try to maintain it the best we can by not disturbing it. And the problem is in this pharmacological paradigm that we live in, we tend to use those drugs that affect how the microflora of the gut works, and that causes major problems sometimes in how it functions. So our intestinal tract is really an important factor in wellness. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on the gifts of terminal cancer. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can we create wellness through national prevention policies? And can dogs sniff out superbugs? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
We have a friend that has two types of cancer, and he has written up something that's called Gifts of Terminal Cancer. He also has been writing about his cancer journey. And he's just like this amazing person. He has such a positive attitude and so much hope. And he has been told over and over again about watching and waiting. And then he's hoping for no metastasis. And his doctors recommend all kinds of things. And he really thinks on his own two feet. You know, he really takes responsibility for himself and his own decisions, much like what you did, only he's not a doctor. I joked and told him that I thought that he should be a doctor in his next life.
Right.
But the doctors recommended at one point that he get a hip replacement because the cancer had metastasized to his bones and everything. And his wife had had this serious injury and she needed help. And he wasn't really having that much pain in his hip and didn't really want to have the surgery. And he thought, well, then there'll be two cripples. So he decided to just kind of like put it off and strengthen his muscles and so forth. It hadn't metastasized and it felt okay. So the surgeon finally said, well, if it feels okay, okay, you know. But a lot of what he's done is partnered with his doctors and all of his decisions and taken into account his quality and his length of life, you know, that was the most important things. He didn't want to get all the x-rays and CT scans that they wanted to do to keep watching and observing how things were going on. He said that he would rather just wait and maybe when an intervention might be necessary due to the pain or a loss of function or something like that, then maybe he would go ahead and do those. But he says he doesn't want to visit the doctors unless he's really feeling bad because he's already had experiences with false alarms and so forth. But what I wanted to share with you mostly is about his gifts of terminal cancer because most people don't think of cancer as being a gift. And one of the things that he says is that it's prompted people to reach out with support and love and appreciation. And he said notes wouldn't have been written and a lot of the calls wouldn't have been made and the visits would have been postponed. And many times friends wait, you know, because they get busy about things in their lives before they, you know, tell you things. And he had a very close friend that died suddenly. And he said when he was of an aneurysm, it was a ruptured aneurysm. When he was at the funeral, he said there were so many beautiful and wonderful things that were written and said about him after he died. And he knows that he would have enjoyed hearing that, you know, while he was alive. And how cancers encouraged him and his wife to no longer procrastinate about the things that are important to them. And they made up a financial plan. And they even, you know, made plans about being proactive, like their funeral and their burial and their organ donation, obituary preferences, all that kind of stuff. He said, without forewarning, that terminal cancer offered that, and he doubt that he would have been so proactive. He said it's also provided the impetus and time for him to write a memoir. He said that their daughters wanted to know more, and so that encouraged him to do that. And he's hoping also in doing this that he can inspire people like others that he's known that have been able to inspire others with their life. And cancer has also encouraged him to reflect upon life's meaning. He said a lot of professional demands had interfered with introspection, and it put him back in touch with his inner self and how he really wanted to spend the limited time that he had. He's traveled quite a bit since he's been diagnosed. The threats of death have pulled him and his wife together. In fact, his wife also had cancer about 10 years ago, multiple myeloma. So when they traveled, they would realize that it might be their last trip wherever it was that they went. And it brought intensity and importance to everything that they experienced together. He said it's helped him to build closer relations with his family and friends. His wife accompanied him to almost all of his doctor appointments and procedures and so forth. And his daughters even went at 4:30 in the morning when they had pre-op preparations for him when he had to have surgery. And then he had friends that were living near where he was going for his surgery that was out of town. And they, you know, met them there and let him spend the night there when he needed to. And he had this incredible support team. And he said he felt surrounded by the light, wrapped in a protective cocoon of love. I just love that. And his vulnerability drew his family and friends closer to him in a more personal way. And so he felt really blessed with that. Many times people are afraid to show their vulnerability. And finally, I guess, he told a story about a tennis player that he really admired. And her freshman year, she lost part of her right arm to cancer. And then she learned to play with her left hand, and she made the team, and she won her doubles match. And then during her sophomore year and during her junior year, the cancer continued to spread, and then she was elected captain of her senior year, but then she died. And he talked about her courage and love and hope and how she had such a positive attitude, full of effort and good sportsmanship, and how she was such an inspiration. And I think that Steve is an inspiration, and he lives with such a positive attitude, and I hope that talking about this will help other people to not wait for a life-threatening illness to be inspired. And let Steve's example inspire you to not put off until tomorrow what you can do today. And he's still kicking.
He's doing great, and he's a dear friend. And it's what you could, it's looking what you could do when catastrophe strikes. You know, the old Chinese proverb is that opportunity is possible when disaster strikes, and it's so true. And it's so tempting for us in situations like this to go along with, oh, this is terrible news, it's rotten, it's all bad, and it's not. Yes, nobody wants to get a cancer or a life-threatening illness or something that's going to disable you, but if you've got one, do what you can to make it better.
And how wonderful to be able to accept and be positive about it. It reminds me some of your book, A Return to Healing, where you talk about healing versus curing.
Absolutely. You know, talking about A Return to Healing in my book there, you know, we talk about the standard American diet. And the standard American diet is sad. It's SAD for standard American diet, but it's really true. We've got deficiencies of all kinds, like of essential fatty acids and excesses of things like trans fats and too much sugar and too much fructose in our diet. And one of the things I think that's really important is to create health and wellness. And we need to do that by inspiration if we can. But if we fail at that, which we have, then we start looking at ways to not just inspire, but to create laws that will legislate our way into pressuring people to follow a diet that's more healthy.
I know there was just an article in the Public Library of Science recommending taxes on soft drinks and bad fats and
sure.
subsidized fruits and vegetables. The trouble is, if when things like this are forced on people, they tend to resist it.
Well, that's right. But if you increase the price of them, it's going to make it less possible for people to buy it. But it's not going to solve the problem entirely, because you need to understand and want to do things different if you really want to solve the problem. And if you look at the national government and what it's doing, I mean, follow what President Bush did twice. He vetoed a bipartisan bill to increase cigarette tax to fund health care for 10 million uninsured children. And that's a terrible thing to do. And it's about following the dollars. And yet when Obama came into the presidency, well, the first thing he did is make sure that he signed that bill. Now, there are differences in what people do, but the politics of what's happening is what we're talking about here. You look at spending $100,000 per preemie, okay, and with the most common cause of premature birth being a smoking mother, which could cost about $50 to teach a mother not to smoke.
Rather than $100,000.
Yeah, I mean, it would make a lot more sense to be proactive, wouldn't it? Why is the FDA riddled with conflicts of interest? Where is Congress in protecting us against things like this? Can sanity win over corruption? That's what's in this book, A Return to Healing, that I recommend that everybody have a copy of, just because it looks at what are the challenges that we face in this country with our healthcare system.
Well, we really need to start focusing more on prevention. There's a little of that coming out, but we need more, like funding exercise programs and incentives with insurance and expanding, you know, competitive sports and subsidizing businesses and supporting exercise and taxing the junk food and subsidizing sustainable agriculture and healthy foods and healthy supplements and getting away from genetically engineered foods and, you know.
Well, that's right.
And we should only have healthy foods in schools and hospitals. And we need public education programs.
There are so many things that we could do if we're really interested in making our health better, if it was service that was our primary thing, but as soon as we start getting things all mixed up and we start looking at return on investment and profitability and supporting things like GMO foods, which I think are just crazy, or to have all this high fructose corn syrup in our diets and subsidizing the corn industry at the same time makes no sense.
How about subsidizing food supplements like vitamin D? Because we have like an epidemic of a shortage of vitamin D.
That's right.
And essential fatty acids.
Absolutely. So we should be requiring insurance companies to provide more general kinds of health care as well. That I think that all state licensed health services that are provided should be required by insurance companies to reimburse for.
I think we need to get rid of the direct-to-consumer ads also and advertise lifestyle.
No question.
These ads are so many of them are sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies and just trying to encourage people to take drugs and then other ones on junk food.
There are a whole lot of things we could do, and I think it needs to be more public education. It needs to start at the kindergarten level and go through every level of activity that we have in education. So our next topic here is looking at
is
dogs.
Woof woof.
Yeah.
Dogs sniff C. diff. Can you believe that dogs can be better diagnosticians than the technology that we have in medicine?
It's a beautiful thing.
I mean, besides sniffing for breast and lung cancer and diabetes, dogs can now detect Clostridium difficile, also known as C. diff, which causes a life-threatening gastrointestinal infection, which is resistant to antibiotics. And these dogs can accurately screen an entire ward in 10 minutes.
And that, think of what that would cost in all the lab testing we would do. And it's accurate when you're looking at 90% sensitivity, meaning they're accurate that much of the time, and even more in terms of being accurate when they say there's something there. That's a pretty good test. Most tests in medicine aren't that good.
Well, we always make fun of dogs for sniffing, you know.
Right.
Well, but we already know that they can be trained to detect money and drugs and bed bugs and explosives and firearms and cell phones.
Isn't that something they can detect, a cell phone? That's just wild.
Well, you know, they can be good watchdogs and seeing eye dogs and hearing impaired. I saw on TV the other day about how this war veteran had post-traumatic stress disorder and how this dog was so comforting to him. The dog could tell when he was starting to get anxious, and he would, whatever he did to him, I don't know, he'd comfort him somehow. And they help the disabled. I mean, but, you know, one of the things I was thinking of, what about protecting the dog from C. difficile?
Oh,
walking around the wards?
Well, no, they're just sniffing it. I mean, that doesn't – their sensitivity and their nose is so much better than a human being nose that it's amazing. So you don't have to worry about the dog getting C. diff. I mean, people very often don't pass C. diff from person to person that much unless there's contact that's a lot more personal than sniffing. So I think that when we're looking at bringing dogs into medicine to do the things that they do, it's really impressive. I mean, they can sniff for cancer, and they can find out if you have lung cancer or if you have diabetes that's out of control, or find breast cancer. I know that there's a doctor who's an acupuncturist, Michael Broffman, up in San Anselmo, California, that published articles on the whole business of sniffing dogs that can find cancer that's breast cancer. And it's published in major journals. That would be sometimes maybe a better way to think about what we need to do to be able to get the job done without spending a whole lot of money. So maybe the canine approach to diagnosis is something that we need to think about. I like the idea of using dogs. And dogs do a lot of other things that are really important too. Think about the companionship, and there's a lot of work on that going on in hospitals.
Well, many people say it's a good thing to take them to convalescent hospitals for the patients to make them feel better.
All right. We're at the close of the show here. I'd like to remind you that we're back to talk live about what's new in the news in health and take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsabuda.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be archived and available 24/7 on PRN.fm.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
We'll see you next time.